Okay, we resume our meeting and continue discussing IAS 1, but on a different subject. I give the floor to April.
Thanks, Tom. We're now discussing Agenda Paper 8C, which deals with the classification of liabilities between current and non-current. And in the paper, this topic's been discussed several times over the last 3 years, and in the paper, we give quite a lot of detail about those discussions, because the purpose of the paper is to arrive at an alternative or development of this topic. There were two submissions originally to the Interpretations Committee about this topic, and they deal with the perceived asymmetry between the requirements. Paragraph 69 of IAS 1 relates to the classification of current liabilities, and it says that an entity should classify a liability as current when it doesn't have an unconditional right to defer settlement for 12 months. Paragraph 73 relates to non-current liabilities, and it says if an entity expects and has the discretion to refinance or roll over the obligation for 12 months, it should be non-current. And the submitters both thought that having an unconditional right to defer settlement in 69D isn't the same as having the discretion to refinance or roll over the obligation in 73. So we look at what the original discussions were in 2010 on the subject, what outreach was conducted, and at paragraph 18, we arrived at the Interpretation Committee recommendation that this should be an annual improvement, and the purpose of the annual improvement would be to clarify when you had a refinance and a rollover and what those terms would be to be non-current. And that would be that it would be with the same lender and on the same terms. And in September 2011, you agreed to that, but that you asked that in the basis for conclusion, there should be additional guidance on what the same terms mean. The exposure draft on the 2010 to 2012 annual improvement included that guidance in the form of derecognition guidance from financial instruments. If the liability had been derecognized, it couldn't be the same liability and it would be non-current. Paragraph 21 to 25 deal with the comment letter analysis which came in. The comment letters raised a number of quite serious issues about the derecognition of financial instrument guidance. And accordingly, the Interpretations Committee withdrew their recommendation to include this as an annual improvement and said it should be a narrow-focused amendment which would go directly to the board. And in March of this year, you accepted that recommendation. At the March meeting, there were a couple of approaches of how we could go forward with this. One was that we carried on looking at the difference between rollover and refinancing, but that we looked at a better form of guidance whether the terms were similar or not. Another approach that was suggested by the staff was that we look at the meaning of unconditional compared with discretion, and another approach would be distinguish settlement of liability from refinancing and rolling over. And so in paragraph 28, we wonder really if it's worth going over that ground again and whether we should just take a step back and say that IAS 1 is concerned with the overall requirements for the presentation of elements in a general purpose standard, and should we be better off just looking at a more general approach to classification, which is less dependent on specific borrowing fact patterns and wouldn't require definition of the term. And thinking about that and looking at the two clauses in IAS 1 that seems to cause the problem. In paragraph 31, we note that the principle that they have in common is deferring settlement of the liability for at least 12 months. And so we wonder whether the non-current classification really arises because there's a contractual arrangement in existence at the reporting date that means that the entity is not going to have to settle the liability for 12 months. And so in paragraph 34, the staff recommend an approach whereby we think about the classification of liabilities based on the contractual arrangements that are in place. And the classification of a liability would be dependent or non-current on whether it's a contractual arrangement that's intended to result in the liabilities being settled in more than 12 months. And we think that that's the principle that underlies the wording in both 1690 and 73. And looking at developing that possible general approach further, the rest of the paper looks at a couple of aspects of that. One is the contractual right, the unconditional right, which we talk about in 1690. In paragraph 36, we suggest, do we really mean unconditional? Because if you think about borrowing and loan agreements, they generally have some sort of condition in them, either that you can't borrow from someone else or that your gearing or other ratios have to be maintained. And the standard itself, we think, acknowledges that there's that unconditionality, because in paragraph 74 of the standard, they talk about if you breach one of these conditions, it then becomes non-current. So we think there's a confusion there, and we would recommend that we delete unconditional in paragraph 38, because it doesn't seem to add anything. I don't think that removing it, it would get rid of the tension between 69 and 73. And it would also, we think, still be true to the principle that it's whether or not you're repaying 12 months after the reporting date based on what arrangements you have in place. Paragraph 42, we outline what we think the benefits of this general approach would be. We wouldn't have to distinguish between rollover and financing. It would be the arrangement in place at the year end. And also, of course, we wouldn't have to know whether the terms of the financing and the rollover were the same. It also means that we wouldn't be looking at specific fact patterns relating to debt, and so we wouldn't have to try and anticipate what sorts of terms people would be asking us to interpret. And we wouldn't have to define any of those terms, so we wouldn't have any unintended consequences of going down a strict definitional route. Now then, finally, the rest of the paper is concerned with other considerations. If we did go with this general approach, what we could include in that, and I think most significant of that would be linking this with cash, which we discussed in paragraph 44 to 47. We've noted that investors find this linkage with cash quite useful. It also has a benefit because a cash outflow is obviously quite a specific event, so it would make that a bit easier to understand. Liabilities themselves are defined in terms of outflows and resources from the entity. And so our recommendation would be, if we develop this, that we would look into that. And then there are a couple of other topics that we discuss, the compliance with covenants, alignment with US GAAP, significance of management expectations. So turning to the questions on page 19, staff recommendation is that we would go with a general approach. The first question is, do you agree with the staff recommendation to develop a more general approach that would be based on the arrangements that are in place at the reporting date?
I already told April privately that I think I don't want to preempt this discussion, but I think it's a rather commonsensical solution that is reached in this paper. And what I just don't believe is, you know, this takes us three years, six discussions in the interpretations committee, and twice by us. And I don't know how this is going to end, but perhaps we can send it back again. This is, how is this possible? Can't we short circuit our decision making a little bit? We go through these extremely lengthy processes, and then we find out that the route we have taken is no good. This is just unbelievable. For such a small, simple issue. Okay, who disagrees with the staff recommendation?
I'll go first. I agree with the recommendation, but I haven't fully understood the cash flow thing. But I'm willing to let it go until I see the drafting. But I've read it a couple of times, and I can't quite grasp what you're getting to.
And I think if we put in wording to link it with cash, we would also have to put in something to exclude the equity settled liabilities, which are already covered in paragraph 74.
So it raises the question, do we really need to put that cash flow thing in, or could we just do a general approach without it?
And I think if I brought back a paper to... the board at the next paper, we could term that in what changes do we think we'd make to the standard, which would be relatively few. I think we'd get rid of the unconditional bit, and we just put a couple of sentences in to say the principle is 12 months or not. And then we could have, as a second stage of that paper, now do we want to make it more explicit about the cash link? Because there's a little bit of tweaking that we'd want to develop in that, I think.
I'm happy with that.
I don't disagree with the staff, but I'm not sure that this solves all the issues. There was a discussion about refinance, the meaning of refinance, with the same lender or with another lender. And it's not very clear in the current wording whether refinancing on similar terms with another lender would allow to say this liability is non-current. It is concerned because I can refinance with another one. Is that very clear now? Or is this a question? I think there is some interpretation issues about this change of lender.
Well, I think if you had a change of lender, one lender would expect the other lender, the existing lender would expect to be paid off.
Yes.
So I think there would be an outflow of cash.
Right, but the current wording, as you propose, doesn't really clarify that question, I think. Because we say refinance or rollover. Clearly, to me, and I ask bankers with me, ex-bankers, rollover means with the same lender, right?
Yeah.
Refinance, to me, seems to mean in most cases change the lender to a new one. So there will be a cash outflow and a cash inflow on the same terms. And that, in that case, can I say, because I have an agreement in place, does that mean I can say my current liability, is non-current? Or do I say it's current because there will be a new lender?
I think that would be current because the arrangement in place at the year end was that you settled that liability within 12 months.
So what do we say as a discussion to refinance? And that permits me to say it's non-current. Refinance is a new lender.
Yeah, and I think refinance is a new lender and it is a settlement of a liability within 12 months.
Exactly.
If an entity expects another discussion to refinance after reporting, it classifies the obligation as non-current, although there is a cash outflow and a cash inflow. So does that exception stay? And do we agree with it?
I think refinancing with another lender would not be current. Would be current, would not be non-current.
Okay, but 73 says the opposite. As a discussion to refinance. There is an agreement in place at the closing date, I can refinance for 12 months, right? Then I classify the obligation as non-current. It's what 73 says, and I think it's wrong. Or you tell me it's wrong, and I agree.
And I think you're probably right, and I think we should consider getting rid of refinance on that.
But that comes in part of your discussion about whether we want to make any clarifications about cash, isn't that correct? That was assumed in your second question.
Yeah.
Then I think with cash, man, I understand it because it is related to refinance and rollover, but there could be also other settlements. Man, if you have debt security, you can settle with that, and maybe you have netting agreement and then not cash transfer. So I think really we have to look at this cash. I think we should not exclude other settlements which maybe are not refinancing, not rollover, because there could be other circumstances where you can settle on a non-cash basis, but which I think then that is a current obligation.
I think we should start with a basic, simple case, and then if we have some specific complex agreements, maybe look at it separately. Yeah?
Patrick? I'm in favor of the staff recommendation. I think April did a very nice job of analyzing the issues and as you said, Hans, pulling together what has, I think, been kind of a, unfortunately, lengthy conversation we've been having about this. My key concern here is paragraph C, where we talk about covenants contained in arrangements in place at the reporting date, or agreements in place at the reporting date. In U.S. GAAP, today, you have, if you will, I'll call them kind of exceptions or loopholes, where if you are in violation of an agreement at a reporting date, but then before you issue the financial statements, if you get a waiver, that would still permit you to classify as long-term, or if there's a breach of some sort. I'm hoping that we would not entertain those types of exceptions because I think they contribute to misleading information in the financial statements. So contractual arrangements in place at the reporting date, the words you use I think are very critical, not when the financial statements are issued. And I guess we can come back and look at examples, but if an entity doesn't have an arrangement in place to refinance, in my mind, that's short-term debt. So the agreement has to be in place at the reporting date to call it long-term. Otherwise, you have to have a negotiation, and it may not.
I don't think under our understanding that that would actually be long-term because you're settling one liability and replacing
it. Right. Agreed. Okay. Good.
Mary?
I support the staff's conclusion that we should stop trying to reconcile without changing paragraph 69, paragraph, 73, and, you know, doing lots of discursive analysis of how you can read it. So let's just go in and address the, you know, the words that seem inconsistent. I think your focus on unconditional probably is a good start. Like Ian, I struggled with the point about cash flows because I had read this paper as implying that we keep the notion that's there as refinancing equals long-term. And I, too, was struggling with the notion of if I have an agreement in place with Bank B to replace my financing from Bank A, isn't Bank A being settled in the fact that Bank B might make the payment to Bank A? To me, still, I think you have to start thinking about things like principal agents, et cetera, before concluding that I do not have a cash flow. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to overcomplicate this, but the message wasn't clear to me from the paper about that. And I was concerned that we were saying as long as I did not have a net cash outflow, that I had no cash flows and therefore it was all a continuation, even if it's a different lender on different terms. So good to stop trying to reconcile the words, face the fact that we have to make some amendments. Let's be careful about this settlement. And last, and like Patrick, I think the discussion about covenants is important, and maybe when we explain why we're taking out, if we go ahead with taking out unconditional, we talk about the situation that exists at the reporting date in terms of whether you are in compliance with the covenant and impacting your assessment of current or non-current.
Yeah, and I think what we'll do over the next month or so is speak to people individually about the fine tuning of the wording. This is just to get agreement about the general thing.
But I think it's compliance with the covenant rather than the existence of any covenants, because I agree with you, if you have a material adverse change clause, you could argue that no debt is ever non-current, and that doesn't seem to be too sensible.
Stephen?
Well, I wouldn't take away unconditional. I think we're being too generous and potentially showing short-term finances long-term.
So do you think in practice we would ever get long-term finance if we required it to be unconditional?
Well, yes. But I don't know what the solution is, but I just feel we're going too far. I think I'd prefer to see it as short-term and then disclosure of the rights to refinance and defer settlement. I don't have a good solution for you, but I worry that we're just being over-generous.
Okay.
Two points I just want to make. One is the point that Mary made in the refinance situation is the substitution of one lender by the other. Probably there is no real cash outflow other than a memo entry. So memo entry, that means you have not exchanged the cash, you have not done anything, but, you know, lender A said, I will step into the shoes of lender B, I will take out this loan. So what do you do in those circumstances would be helpful. And also, what happens in a situation of consortium in the logical extension of that thought process, because you have a consortium of bankers coming in. Similar to this, I just want to think, because I don't think this general approach is going to solve the problems, but it's a worthy attempt to think about it, but I don't know whether it solves, because although Han said it's such a small issue, but it's a huge issue in the balance sheet classification of short term and long term, and it has a potential for going concerns, opinions and things of that nature. The knock-on effects are unbelievable. Auditors have gone down in their careers just for screwing up this area. One point though, I just want to make sure that you're thinking about when you're doing this. If I have the same lender, I borrowed $1 million, I'm substituting the same $1 million with another $1 million from thing, but the interest change, rate change. So what happens is that, is that 10% rule still comes into play here? How do you define the 10% rule to say that the net cash flows are different, therefore it's a new loan, so you need to think about it in a different way. So I don't think this is as simple as it sounds. I think there are many layers to it we need to think through.
I think I'll take it along. I mean, I think we haven't thought about Philip and the wording in that much detail, but my first reaction to the first thing where you're rolling over with the same lender would obviously be not a settlement liability. If you've got a new lender, I think even if there's no growth, no net cash inflow or outflow, there is a gross cash inflow and outflow. So I think you are settling that liability when you're going to another.
I don't have any disagreement with that thought. I'm just saying that we need to flush those things clearly.
I do realize that we need to put some thought into the wording itself.
And also, if the net cash flow changed by 10%, what do you do?
I think we'd be walking away from the idea of going down the financial instruments route, and we'd be just looking much more, are we settling this or not? And so on that basis, if you are not settling the liability with the original lender, but you're just going to roll it over next year, but on less advantageous terms or more advantageous terms, I don't think that affects the classification of the...
But it means that you're settling one loan to a new loan. So then the question comes down to is that did you settle it? So I think the underpinning is did you settle on a gross basis?
Jung-woo?
Yes, thank you. Just a small minor two suggestions. One is based on the paragraph 53 and 56, how much confidence level for using the term expect, because you know this issue is coming and coming out in different standards in the revenue project and classification measurement project. You know, they are thinking this expect is probable or highly probable. So there will be one issue in upcoming papers. So this is a IS 1, the general standard. So it might be clarify what how much confidence
in intense. As ability, discretion, and intense to have an expect.
Yeah. Okay.
Another thing is. I really happy to see you are taking a general approach to solve this headache problems. In real world, many people are asking to classify non-current rather than current liabilities. So this is quite a tricky issue. So I really like you taking the general approach. But on top of that, how about taking the register category, I mean the current liability is as a register category rather than the currently the IS-1 is taking the non-current liabilities as a register category. So if you satisfy this and A and D, you can classify current liabilities. Otherwise, you have to classify the non-current assets, a non-current liability offers. So if we take their financial instrument approach, if you cannot apply amortized cost, then everything must be classified as fair value P&L. So that's a kind of a very conservative approach to the market, I guess. It's not easy, but if you think that general approach about this issue, then there may be one possible.
And that's a good point, because one of the tensions is where you've got one being defined as residual and the other not. And what we'd like to have is symmetry between the two, so that there isn't that conflict or potential for conflict.
Gary?
I mean, I support where you're going. I think, you know, general approaches make actually life easier. So you get refinancing rollover, and there's probably a dozen other terms you could apply to it. And if you start getting specific, you start getting, you know, get people working the way around them, because you're defining a lot of terms, there's going to be gaps between those terms. I think general is the right way to do it in here. I think this is perhaps a bigger subject than meets the mind. I think as long as it's a narrow focused amendment, I think we're good where we are. But, you know, for example, lender, you know, is it what I think right now I would leave it alone as a generic, but even inside a lender, different legal entities may very well be the funding agent, and the and today it might be a lender might do as a principal, tomorrow the same lender might be the front, you know, for a consortium behind it and so on. So I think I would leave it as a general thing, but I do think it's a bigger subject than perhaps meets the mind. And as we had discussed, I would probably would disagree if we was asked to vote on this particular one or not, about why couldn't the lender be a different lender, you know, as long as you have it in place financing. But that's not what you're asking us to vote on. I think we got to keep this narrow to get it done.
Okay, so I feel there's general support for the general approach, but a few suggestions for the definitive wording. And
that's right, and the second part of the question is about unconditional and settlement. I think we've actually covered that in the discussion.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, then we continue with the annual improvement.
Hmm? 18. And
Ten. Okay. Shannon?
In April, the Interpretation Committee received a request to clarify the presentation requirements for items of other comprehensive income and IAS loans. Specifically, it was requested that the presentation requirements in paragraph 82A should be amended in order to clarify how an entity should present its share of the OCI of associates and joint ventures accounted for using the equity method. The issue was originally discussed by the Interpretations Committee in July of this year. In that meeting, the committee agreed with the staff recommendation and recommended that the IASB amend paragraph 82 to clarify that the share of OCI of equity accounted investments be presented in aggregate as a single line item, classified by whether those items will be subsequently reclassified to profit and loss. The Interpretations Committee originally recommended this as an annual improvement, but after internal discussions, it was decided it would be more expedient to bring it to the board in the form of the other amendments to IS-1 coming out of the disclosure initiative. The issue originally arose because the June 2011 amendments to IS-1 deleted the portion of the old version of paragraph 82 which related to components of OCI and introduced new requirements in paragraph 82A, which is reproduced in the staff paper. Previously, paragraph 82 required that the share of OCI of equity accounted investments be presented in a single line item in accordance with the staff recommendation. However, the new paragraph was seen to give rise to the interpretation specifically that it should be presented by nature. The submitter asserted that the language in this new paragraph is ambiguous and that it resulted in diversity in practice. Additionally, we performed outreach with IFAS, IOSCO, and ESMA, and most respondents agreed that the language should be clarified and noted that there was diversity in their jurisdictions. The submitter noted three particular views that have arisen in practice. The first is presentation in aggregate as a single line item. The second is presentation by nature in separate line items. And then the third is presentation by nature in the same line items as similar items of the reporting entity.
The Interpretations Committee agreed with the staff recommendation that V1 is the most appropriate, and the primary reasons for this are that it's consistent with practice prior to the June 2000 amendments to IS1, and the ISB had no particular discussions about changing the OCI presentation requirements. And that's further reflected in the original exposure draft for the June 2011 amendments. It's also most consistent with current implementation guidance that presents a single line item of OCI. And also, to present items of OCI for equity accounted investments by nature would be inconsistent with the presentation requirements for the entity shares of profit and loss of equity accounted investments, which are in paragraph 82 of IS1. It's also inconsistent with the equity accounting overall, because IS 28 requires that an entity's interest in the net assets of an investee be presented in a single line item. And then in terms of concerns about limiting disclosures, we believe that there appear to be already adequate disclosure requirements in IFRS 12, paragraph 20, that would capture any significant disclosures. Therefore, the Interpretations Committee recommended to revise paragraph 82 to clarify that items of OCI arising from equity accounted investments be presented in aggregate as a single line item, still classified by whether or not they'll be reclassified to profit and loss, and then also to revise the implementation guidance to IS1 to reflect that presentation by nature is not a requirement. Now, the staff believes that this, as this is only a minor clarification, there is no relief necessary for first-time adoption, and also no additional disclosures are necessary due to the disclosure requirements in IFRS 12, paragraph 20. So the question to you is, does the ISB agree with the Interpretation Committee's recommendation to amend paragraph 82A of IS1 and provide consequential amendments to the implementation guidance to clarify the requirement for the presentation of the OCI arising from equity accounting?
Harry? Maybe I'm missing something, because I'm on page 9 in the rewrite of 82A. It says classified by nature grouped into those. That doesn't sound like view 1 presented in the aggregate. Am I missing something?
Right. So 82A, subparagraph A, is only for other items of other comprehensive income. And we specifically include the share of other comprehensive income of equity accounted investments, which is presented in subparagraph B. And so, therefore, we're excluding that requirement from nature.
Subparagraph A is the group's own.
Yes, okay. It's two regimes. It's two different regimes, one for group companies and one for associates.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. Thank you.
Could I have a backup question to that? If you go to 82A little B, you say you'll have one line, which is a share of a comprehensive income, analyzed between portions. What does analyze mean? You do it in a note, or do you do it on, I don't quite understand.
Well, that language should be the same as in little A, that in accordance with other grouped into those that. So that language could be made uniform with the language in little A to reflect that.
You can use the word presented.
Right.
Yeah. You mentioned about the disclosure. You know, I'm not following. You want to say there will be enough or adequate disclosure about the separate items in nature?
That's right. So the Interpretations Committee, there was some concern that we might be limiting disclosure. However, we felt that paragraph 20 in IFRS 12 would capture any significant items that should be presented by nature arising from OCI, equity accounted investment.
Are you sure?
Well, the Interpretations Committee felt that that would be sufficient. And, of course, there's also the concern that if we were to include the requirement of presenting items of OCI from equity accounted investments by nature, that would also lead the way for perhaps in the future thinking about, well, now we need to change the requirement for presenting items of profit and loss of equity accounts and investments, which have always not had the requirement to be presented by nature. And so we're not limiting entities, and we're not saying that they can't present these items by nature if they're significant. And so we believe that paragraph 20 of IFRS 12 will furthermore require that when it's significant enough to be presented.
You get to say that, you know, we're not preclude you to present in nature.
Right.
Yeah, I have to think it because I'm thinking, you know, in a scenario, the entity organized by such a way, the parent company actually is a shell, no, you know, substantial business. And the main income of business are either organized in a joint venture or another. This means the main source of OCI is not from its own, it's from its the associates and others. Then, you know, to present or disclose the OCI source in nature will be very useful, and otherwise you cannot see. This is why I asked you firstly, if there is adequate disclosure, it's okay. And secondly, if the entity organized by such a way, then the entity decides to present by nature, it also be a possible alternative that can use. If you confirm these two, I feel no problem at all.
Yes, certainly. And we thought quite strongly that paragraph 20 of IFRS 12 would accomplish that.
I'm okay with the direction. I have two small questions about the wording. On paragraph B of 82A, you talk about portions. Analyze between portions.
Yes.
I'm not sure whether it's a matter of portions. It's a matter of nature.
Right.
In the associates, you have items which by nature go to, will be specified on that. So it's not portions. I think you have to think of a different word.
Certainly.
Because portions is captured by share. My 20% of that amount is what I show on a line item, okay? And the second issue is, maybe it's obvious, I'm not sure. When we say we'll be classified subsequently to profit or loss, to which profit or loss? In the associate or in the group? And maybe there is a risk of confusion. Maybe if you say we'll be classified subsequently to profit or loss in the financial statement of the associate or joint venture, it will clearly say that you look at that level to know whether it is reclassified. It has nothing to do with reclassification from the share of income to the profitability of the group.
No, this is referring to in the group, so you take it out of your OCI group into profit or loss of the group.
I think that needs to be clarified. So if it is, I take 20% of the financial statements of my associate, which shows items that will be reclassified within the associate, or between the associate and the group?
Yeah, I mean, it may be triggered by something that happens in the associate, but we're talking here about what happens at the group level.
Yeah, it's not very clear. I think it needs to be clarified at what level you look at the reclassification.
It could only be at the group level because it depends on what you then did.
I'm not sure.
Doug? Yes, the same point. I think this is an improvement I would like to support, but I wonder whether this is really useful information. Because you say that in the paragraph 82A, B, so we have to disclose whether it will be recycled or not. But if you are using equity method, equity accounting, if you see the equity accounting, you would recycle anyway. So the point Philip raised is very important. The nature of the recycle is different from A and B. So, of course, it's useful, but there is a danger of confusing readers because nature itself is completely different. So we are providing more information, but could confuse readers. So that's why I was wondering whether it's really useful.
We'll have a think about that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Any more comments? No? And I think there's broad support for the approach and also some suggestions for drafting and some feedback. Thank you.
It's rather than break, we just move on, because we can't start until 12:15, because
yes.
Beyond. We've got a break scheduled, let's just take half an hour, we'll have to have another break in half.
No, so we, no, we move on.
Yeah.
Mike.
Okay, thank you.